Welcome to the Dell Golf Podcast.
My name is David Adele, and let's sit down at the workbench and talk about how we can play our best golf. Welcome to the Dell Podcast. Today I have with me one of my most favorite best friends in the world, a guy I've chewed so much dirt with over the years. This is Mike Shy, who's going to be on the podcast with me. I've known Mike since, when did we first meet? I think it was at a Henry Griffiths conclave that we had up in Coeur d'Alene, I think around 1997, somewhere in there, 98, yeah, 97 probably.
That's right. Maybe even before that, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
I think all I remember is you standing up for the golfing machine and and everybody ready to throw stuff at you.
And I thought,
that's the guy I want to be friends with.
Yeah. Just for the listeners to know, Mike's been a fitter for me with Adele Golf, helped guide my career, helped me in so many ways, not only by being one of my best friends, but being a great golf professional and a visionary. And we connected immediately and it's never stopped. And I take a lot of pride in being his friend and have enjoyed my relationship with Mike since the very beginning. Mike, tell me something about you, something that the listeners would want to know about Mike Shy. What winds you up?
Well, I think my biggest passion, and again, by the way, thanks for that. I consider you, again, this could be a love fest for a minute, but again, you're one of my best friends in the world, and it's very rare. If I ever asked you for something or help or whatever, you were there every single time, you know, especially, you know, in the beginning journey of with Bryson as well, and other students. I mean, not just Bryson, but others as well. And so I think, again, my biggest passion is how, and the reason I keep teaching is that I want to help people. And that's been my, you know, I take it very personally when let's say a student, quote, fails, even though they're not necessarily failing. And I don't sleep. I lose sleep over that because am I failing them in some way? And so my passion to help somebody fulfill their goals, their dreams, their desires, their passions, that's probably, you know, my biggest, that's what I want more than anything.
Yeah. So Mike and I have a common background with our teacher, Ben Doyle, who was, you know, the foremost, you know, golf machine instructor at the time. And so we've always had that connection. Mike is, in my opinion, one of the greatest golf professionals in the business. I've been around all of them. And Mike has not only a singular passion to help people improve, but he also thinks out of the box, and he's not a repackager. And I mean that in the greatest way, because so many golf professionals out there grab information from other pros and repackage it as their own belief system and structure that they invented. And Mike isn't that kind of a person. He gives credit to where he gets his knowledge and his connections, and that's what makes him a great thinker. And he is a great thinker. So what's your philosophy on teaching? I know that's a pretty broad, you know.
Yeah, but it's, you know, it's been asked of me before, like it, I'm sure, you know, asked of you all the time. But I think it evolves. And so, you know, the one thing that I've said this constantly is that the longer I do this, the less I know. And so I think I'm always, you know, it's so easy in the beginning as a young golf professional, young teacher to put everybody in a box. And so, and I think that's a detriment to your teaching. I think it's a detriment to individuals that you're working with. And so, you have to look at the individual, who they are, and try to devise. And I don't think it can be done in one lesson, two lessons, or like my environment, it has always been more from a coaching perspective. And so getting to know a student, how they tick, you know, again, finding out what their goals, their desires are, what their ability to do, how much they're able to work on certain things that you're trying to get across to them. So, you know, that's probably one of the reasons why I love the golfing machine so much is that, you know, homers claim they're 13 trillion swings, just pick one. And so, you know, it's a vast catalog of what you're able to do and how do you, you know, approach that with individual students is difficult, you know, but I think that's overall my, you know, philosophy is to really try to understand the student first before I kind of start heading down a path with them. Because again, I think at times that can be, as all teachers, we've missed the mark when we're trying to do something or diagnose something or help somebody. But, that's also part of learning as a coach. So, let's say I've been coaching or teaching now for 40 years. That's a long time.
Yeah.
And so, I make comments every once in a while that I forgot more than some people know, and so go from there.
Yeah, no, it's the truth. I feel the same way. I feel like as I evolve and I learn and apply the information I've learned from my friends like Mike Shy and you and Ben Doyle and the Chuck Cooks and all these people that I've been fortunate to be around, how much it makes me feel stupid. But in
every time I'm around you, I really feel stupid, that's for sure.
But I mean, it's just that there's always the unknown, the things that we're trying to learn and understand and then apply. And that brings me to, the topic of, I don't know if the listeners know who they're talking to, but Mike is the coach and the developer, the helper, the sounding board for Bryson DeChambeau since he's been a young man. And, which is a testament to Mike's philosophy on how he teaches, is that, arguably Bryson is one of the most recognized, talked about golfer in golf right now other than Tiger Woods. And his approach to the game is changing how the game is looked at. Everything he's done is totally different, from a one-plane swing to putting the way he's putting to single-length golf clubs. And that's just a testament to Mike not, trying to jam him in his box, that he looks at the player and he takes the information and the desires of that player and he works around him. And he's done that with so many of the students. He's built so many great golfers and they're all different. And that's a testament to Mike's teaching philosophy. So we'll talk about Bryson just a little bit. When did you know he was different?
I think probably 12, 13, he was obviously very smart, had a passion that was unlike anything I'd ever, at that age. I mean, most of the time I just hope the kids get through puberty. And so, even Bryson, for that matter, trying to get him through puberty was an adventure. And so, or whatever role I played in that. Bryson played, he was with me probably 30 hours a week. So, it just wasn't a once a week lesson. And so that's what made it so different. And again, as we went through that process of him in his adventure of trying different things and still being, pretty good player. And so even though he struggled at times with things that he would try or want to try, and most of the time that his parents, especially his dad, would blow a gasket on that. But I had to keep, pushing that envelope with him because that was the way he thought. And so he just wanted, if he didn't know something, that's when he got sideways. And even to this day, by the way, it's exactly the same. It hasn't changed one bit. If he doesn't know something, he's a, I'll be nice, he's a bear to work with. And so, and look out, because he gets, pretty uptight during that process. But you got to respect the fact that he wants to figure it out, whatever that might be. So,
yeah. And until
he
puts it to
13 years old, he did the same thing.
Until he can put that to rest, he won't let it go, which is
tenacious. No, he won't let it go at all. Yeah. And so, and you might have the answer, but again, he wants to, feel as most great players, I think. He wants to discover it for himself. Whatever role you play, whether it was a suggestion, I can't tell you how many times I gave him something to do or let's approach it this way. And it was like, nope, that doesn't work. And then you could see him recircle back to that thing and go, oh, okay, yeah, this is what I discovered. And so, again, I never tried to be the one that say, hey, this is all my idea. This is all my thing. It has to be his ideas, his ownership. And I believe that with all great players, it needs to be that. It can never be about, quote, the coach or the teacher or whatever. Obviously, this was a huge team effort in my mind. And, David, you were a huge part of that. Without you, he's not where he is today. 100%. There's no doubt in my mind. It was a you know, having David Adell a part of being my friend who I could rely on, you know, to help find answers, right? Whether it was building the club or as putter or whatever, that was a key role in his discovery. And so without it, I'm telling you, he's not where he is today.
That's nice of you to say that. I mean, a testament to your flexibility and your passion for what you do was when he came up and said, hey, I think playing single-length golf equipment is the way to go. I mean, this is a radical departure, especially from a kid who's already won the California or junior amateur. I mean, he's earmarked to go to any of the top California schools, right? And all of a sudden he pulls out of the hat, I want to play single. I think this is the way to do it. And just so that everybody knows, I didn't invent single length. Tommy Armour did it a while back. Bobby Jones won the Grand Slam with single length equipment. But Bryson said, mechanically, this seems like the most logical thing to do. And there was nothing available to him at the time other than destroying golf clubs and grinding them to lighter and trying to make them heavier. And what was that process like for you guys?
It was brutal. You know, we destroyed, I think, you know, the first thing I did was I took a Henry Griffiths. I had a Henry Griffiths fitting system, and I had a sand wedge, an 8-iron, 5-iron that he could actually go try. It was going to be off weight, whatever. I said, hey, look, you just got to see what it looks like. But it looks really weird when you have a 37-inch sand wedge, and, you know, and it looks kind of weird when the 5-iron is a little bit on the shorter side. So, you know, he went out and said, oh, okay, that's cool. He liked it. Now what's next? And then I had a set of Nike CBs, cavity backs that, you know, definitely deserved to be destroyed. And so, you know, we took it to the grinder. I had on the 3-iron, I think we had to add 50 grams of lead tape, you know, which is not cheap, especially when, you know, I wasn't making any money. Bryson wasn't paying me or anything like that. So, you know, we had to make do with what we could. And so we took the wedges to the grinder and a drill, and because we had to take 30 grams off the wedges, and that's not easy, no. By the way. And so, you know, the process was about a 2-week journey, and then he went out and played, and, you know, his first hole, he hit 8-iron, was no big deal. He said, oh, it's pretty much the same. Went to the next hole, it was like 200 or so, and took the 5-iron out, and he goes, well, here it is, and stuffed it to about 10 feet or so, and looked at me and said, this is a game changer. And so that was the beginning. And then TaylorMade got involved a little bit, made it a little bit easier for us. And then, of course, you, David, were the big key in making a set that was actually, you know, made for, you know, what he was trying to do. So it was an amazing process. It was really cool. And we've taken a lot of flack for it. You know, his dad, when we went to TaylorMade, literally told me on the way down, my kid is not coming back with a set of one-length clubs or single-length clubs, right? And so I mean, the whole way down, man, he's not playing these, you know? And we went out to the range, and he did something that no player that the fitter had ever seen done. Every club, 3-iron to sand wedge, he was at 90 miles an hour, 15-yard increments, and the rest is history. So it was a real cool process. It was amazing what he did. And how he kept committed to that process as well.
Yeah, no, it was, you know, for me, you know, it was quite an undertaking. One, only because of what it would take to make a set. You know, I didn't get paid for it either, right? So, and all I knew was that Bryson believed in it. And most importantly, you did too. And so that gave me the conviction to try to figure it out. And luckily I had the resources and the blanks to be able to make that first set for him, which he was like a kid in a candy store when he got that first set of irons. He was like, I finally have a real set of golf clubs.
And, yeah, no doubt.
And the rest is history. And it was, you know, a process of working through shafts and, you know, all the variables that are involved in it. Why do you think there's this apprehension out there to play single length equipment?
Well, I think, again, it's because of what he does first and foremost, right? So the first thing is his golf swing looks funky. That would be the first thing that people would assume, or that myth that they think, oh, okay, Bryson swings on quote one plane. Oh, that's why he plays the single length golf clubs, right? So that's the first step. So the second part is that his irons are super upright, right? Because mm-hmm. of the way he swings. That was the other part. The third part is he, you know, uses the ginormous, you know, the Jumbo Max grips. So, and that's unconventional, you know, and then he wears the, you know, the funny hat. So you put all those things together and it just created this, well, if you, the only way you can use the clubs is if you swing like Bryson, you know, which is a total, you know, fallacy or myth out there. So, and we've begun trying to market that, help that get rid of that myth that you can swing your swing with a set of single length clubs. I mean, you do not have to have, you know, Bryson's swing, you know, and so on to be able to work those golf clubs. There's a groundswell, obviously, with your clubs, it's been great.
What do you think the benefits are of single length over conventional staggering?
Well, again, for me, I think overall, let's say if I look at it, all the kids that I've gotten into, you know, a single length golf club, that it was just easier to learn, right? And so even though maybe they stopped at a 6-iron and went down, and then we would do, you know, something like a hybrid or a 7-wood or a 5-wood. But again, the fitting process to me is no different than a variable. In fact, in the fitting process is better because you have multiple clubs to even try and test versus a typical fitting where it's either a 7-iron or a 6-iron and that's it and 3 shafts. You know, and so from a customer service standpoint, I think it's a way better process. And so the next part was, again, if I just look at beginning golf, it's so much easier to learn with the same club length clubs, you know, and the same weight because everything, quote, feels the same, number one, even though I hate that term feel. But the reality is that they can go from the 7-iron, you know, to the wedge, to a sand wedge, to, you know, a 6-iron. And feel like, oh, the golf swing, it's all the same. It's not super complicated, you know, whereas as an instructor, I would teach people, you know, here, let's start with a 9-iron or an 8-iron. And then they have this 5-iron in the bag and they go, well, what do I do with this? And you're like turning it upside down in their bag going, let's not go there for a while. Because again, it takes time to learn that longer club. It's different feel, different sensations and so on. And so I think overall, it's just a better way to learn, number one. Number two, as a good player, again, I think the consistencies that we've proven through, you know, a proximity test, forward and back, and then side to side, that the single leg golf club is just it's a better mousetrap. And now, again, seeing like what you've done, especially with your club as well, and how the clubs are actually progressing, they're getting better. And so considering where we started 6 years ago, you know, with a hodgepodge and a, you know, destroying the integrity of a club to try to make it work, to actually having golf clubs that are made for, you know, the single length purpose, it's to me, it's going to be fun to see what it's like 3 or 4 years from now.
Yeah. I mean, I was, you know, I didn't want to be the only one out there doing it either. Right. I just wanted to be the best at it. And I was glad Cobra created single length or one length as they call it. Because, you know, it provided that bigger vehicle to create the traction to make this work. Because it really, I mean, you know, as you've taught many beginners, as I have, that you start out in a 7-iron and you get them making contact, and then you start switching the club on them and they can't hit the ball. It's just a pure testament to you. They groove one swing and they understand it. That length is a good length. And then you hand them something else and they can't find the ball, you know.
And I think people need to understand, too, that, you know, that this isn't brand new, number one. Number two is that when clubs were getting sold after Bobby Jones won the Grand Slam, they needed a way to sell to the masses. And that's how the variable length kind of came into play. And that's what we've been doing for a long period of time. And for, you know, basically 100 years, we never bought one club at a time. We bought 8-irons at a time. 3-irons or pitching wedge. That's what we did off the rack, right? And that's what we did. So fitting didn't even kind of happen until the early 80s, right? That, oh, maybe a golf club should be fit. You know, we think it's just automatic now and so on. So, and now you look at full circle, how you literally could go into a shop and buy one club at a time. You could do that. It's not difficult to do all, you know, when you look at something at a store, you're going to see individual SKU numbers on a club. So I feel like it's gone full circle back to the way they used to make hickory clubs, right? Mm-hmm. One at a time, perfect set for that person. It was just very expensive to do back then, and you couldn't do it for the masses, right? So now this is definitely doable. And I, again, it is a testament. Cobra's doing it, obviously. You know, I'm assuming another company was going to pick up, you know, as well. And so it's just a testament of the risk that you took and making this happen. And so, and again, it's, you know, to me, it's the only way. I do fit variable clubs, but again, I would say 90%, you know, it's going to be in the single length or one length category.
Yeah. And so, I mean, a little bit of background information. Mike and I both worked extensively with a company called Henry Griffiths, and the old timers out there probably know who that is as a company, but Randy Henry and Ross Henry and the group of Henry Griffiths were the best club fitting company in the world, in my opinion, because they dynamically fit. They had all the shafts. They were the first to have removable heads so you could fit different shafts and went well beyond lie angle and so many things that Henry Griffiths pioneered. And Mike was a regional for Henry Griffiths. So he has tremendous fitting knowledge. And so that segues into this question. It's like, what is, you know, club fitting mean to you as a golf professional?
Well, you know, again, I always feel like if you go wear a pair of shoes and you just go buy a box and they don't fit you, what are you going to end up doing? You're not going to walk very well.
Yeah.
And so golf club has that same signature as well. If it's not fit properly and or you're buying something just off the rack or so on, it's going to have a signature and it's going to end up causing problems unless you get lucky and it just happens to fit you. But again, I think the fitting process is critical to success. And so I try to look at every nuance in fitting now, whether it's, you know, weight, club head, lie angle, shaft, deflections and twists and torques and all that. You know, it's probably a little bit overboard at times, but that's how my brain kind of starts working. But it's so vital to me to, you know, the success of any player, whether a beginner or in fact, I had a beginner come in the other day. Is it important I get fit? I go, well, let's do the best we can. We don't need a whole set of clubs of, you know, 14 clubs. We need a putter and a couple of lofted clubs and maybe a lofted, you know, either a super hybrid or a lofted 7-wood or something. And that's all you need. And that's all you need to start. But I'd rather try to get you into some kind of category right off the get-go because it's going to help you down the road.
Yeah. For those of you, if you've ever been to Mike's place at Dragonfly, they call it the tent because he has this massive tent and inside of it probably has more stuff than you would can imagine. He's got a $150,000 robo swing trainer. He's got putt view. He's got fitting systems all over the place. I mean, the environment in his tent with the people that come in and hang out, it's a golf junkie's dream to spend time with Mike and in his facility, which is a testament that, you know, it's not cheap to do what you're doing, and you've made the investment, and you always have, to provide everything that you believe your students would need. And if you ever have a chance and you're in the metropolis of Fresno, California, you should stop in and meet Mike and take a lesson from him, because he's truly great at what he does, and he has everything that a teacher would want to do the job correctly. Mike, why have golf professionals given up on fitting? I mean, we see it. We basically see singularity in their choice. They become staff members. They hold hostage their clubs to one brand, their belief structure around why they do it. What's going on with all that?
You know, when I was a regional and I used to talk to golf pros, I think the first thing that a lot of pros would say to me, especially from the teacher realm, that they just didn't want the responsibility if the fit didn't work, mm-hmm. You know, and that was the first step that, you know, hey, the clubs are bad, your fault, you're bad coach, you're bad fitter, you know, and so on. And so that was kind of the what I heard quite a bit from golf pros. You know, I think now, you know, maybe because teaching has become so specialized and that I think players are, or coaches are networking, let's say, with other facilities, and the fitting process potentially is out there. But, you know, in my view, if you're not evaluating the club at all in your teaching still to this day, and that was something that, you know, being around Henry Griffiths, that's what they you know, taught us. And it was true that if you're not evaluating the club, even Bryson at this point, you know, I can't tell you how many times I've been out there. And the next thing you know, I'm like going, hey, man, let's go find a liveboard, which is, by the way, hard to find on the PGA Tour, which is interesting.
Yeah.
You know, but he goes and gets a liveboard and finds out his line goals have changed, which influence him to do something in a way that potentially he's not trying to do.
Yeah.
You know, and so my view has always been a liveboard should be pretty dang close, you know, to when you're teaching. Bryson should be pretty dang close when you're out hitting balls. Just don't assume. And so, and Bryson was always able to tell, hey, my angles are off a degree or 2 degrees. I always found it really interesting that he was able to sense that.
Yeah.
And so on. So, you know, I think, again, even if you're not fitting the golf club, but if you have a lie angle or lie board with you, I don't care if you have TrackMan or FlightScope or whatever, you are not going to be able to tell how that club is interacting with the ground just because you're looking at a divot. I don't care who you are. And I've watched that, I don't know how many times, where a guy thought he knows everything. He's looking at the divot. Oh, look at that divot. Oh, that divot's really good. We put it on a lie board and,
yeah,
you know, that maybe the club was a little more leading edge or was a little trailing or whatever. And again, it's so important, again, for grind. It's important for line angle, face plane, understanding the face plane. So, again, I think it's an aspect that teachers stay away from and don't get trained properly because it turns into selling the golf club versus trying to improve a student.
Yeah, and then, you know, they're essentially, you know, fitting around flaws potentially, and the golf professional's not involved in that process. And, you know, have that client come back with a golf club that they had no control over, and then they're having to deal with it as an instructor. I just never understood the logic in that. I hate to see our profession keep losing segments of our control of the process to outside sources, really, because we should be the smartest guy in the room, right? And to allow someone, you know, to take control of their student's equipment, to me, you know, is kind of a shame, but it's the reality of the way things are going. It's hard for a golf professional to have all the things like you have, to have all these offerings, because, you know, it is daunting and it changes so quickly that, you know, I can see why it happens. It's just a shame. But where do you see your instruction going in the future?
Well, that's, you know what? I never know. That's probably, I don't know if that's a good thing or a bad thing. You know, certainly, you know, you look at online instruction and how it's going and people are relying on that, especially with COVID and all the other stuff that's going on. But, you know, I struggle with that personally because there is that personal touch that's important that, you know, again, the interaction with the students, you know, I was never in this to make a lot of money. And unfortunately for my family and my wife and so on. And that, because in order to be, to me, a proper coach, it takes a lot of time. And I'm in an area that's not so affluent. And so, you know, again, I still believe that you have to understand the makeup of a player way before you start developing, quote, a golf swing. And so, you know, maybe as far as the neuro mind and how the mind works, I guess maybe I could get a lot smarter in that. You know, certainly I'm understanding the body and how the body works. I think that's something in today's teaching, you know, if you don't understand, quote, certain biomechanical terms, you're like thrown to the side. You know, which again, I still somewhat disagree with that because some old school teachers, you know, I would imagine Butch Harmon doesn't know all the little quote, you know, terminology biomechanically that you're supposed to know. And I would say he's still, you know, probably one of the best instructors on the planet. There's no doubt about that. Right. So, you know, or Mike Adams. And Mike Adams is probably one of the most knowledgeable individuals I've ever met in respect to the body and how it works. You know, so again, it's always about continuing education, becoming smarter, getting your mind outside the box. That's the key to me to becoming hopefully a good teacher.
So for years, you know, you were manning your post, working in Fresno, you were moving around California as a regional for Andrew Griffiths. And then all of a sudden Bryson blows up and now you are out on tour all the time. And what has that taught you being out there? What have you learned by now being in the stew pot of what's going on out there? I mean, it's had to be somewhat surreal in the beginning. And then, you know, what have you learned by being out there?
Yeah, a lot. Would take probably hours and hours and hours to probably really go over it.
Because you work with a lot of good players. You work with Bill Glassons and other players, you know, in the day.
Yeah, and that all was, you know, critical to, you know, me handling, I think, you know, Bryson, his personality on tour a little bit. I think that was important. But, the reality of, you know, I wasn't just a swing coach when I was out there. You know, in fact, you know, that was probably the least thing that quote, I would be part of. Probably Bryson would agree with that in some ways. But again, it was the fact that I was there 7 days a week. I was there Monday through Sunday or Monday through Friday most of the time because we were missing a lot of
You were a coach.
Yeah, I was his coach. And so making sure...
Coaching is different than teaching. Coaching is very different than teaching. And because
100%. I mean, I wasn't the normal, you know, all the coaches or teachers that were out there were there Monday through Wednesday and they were gone, right? And then I was there, you know, getting kicked out of the players' dining on Thursday morning because they didn't let teachers in the players' dining. So, you know, so I think, you know, again, it was I was observant. I loved watching other teachers teach. I loved watching other players do what they do. Because I was there 7 days a week, I only had one player. Most people thought I was probably a weird dude. That's for sure. Cause they thought Bryson again was different. So I must be even more different. And so, I think learning again, what players think. I had talked to players, what they were thinking about, what they were doing. I was very fortunate. Some of them were again, very nice to me. And, it was always kind of fun to talk with them. Colin Swatton, who was, Jason Day's coach and teacher and caddy forever. And we became very close. So, you know, I felt like that was important, you know, Bryson becoming a multi-millionaire overnight, you know, and all of his requirements and what he was supposed to do. And if his agent wasn't there, what was my responsibility to get him to interviews? And what happens if you just missed a cut and you had interview responsibility? So, you know, there was a lot going on and it was very, very stressful. And considering I think he missed 22 cuts in his first 2 years, that's a lot.
That is a lot.
Thank God he's...
And there's a lot of emotion that follows missing every one of those, you know, yeah. A lot of doubt and what am I doing and how can I play this way?
Yeah, especially after missing, I think, 12 in a row. That was very difficult.
Wow. Yeah, I can only imagine. But look where we're at now. I mean, it's amazing. And I mean, what does it feel like to... I mean... I've been teaching my whole life. I mean, of my professional career, I'm 25 years as a golf professional this November. Been teaching for 32 years myself, and very seldom in your life will something great as Bryson come along. And very seldom do you get to build a player from the ground up. A lot of these teachers that get accolades, they already get proficient, good, great golfers already, right? So that they keep thinking that teacher is a great teacher, but are they building him from the ground up, you know? And that's a big difference. Ben Doyle built great players,
right?
You build great players from the ground up, and you built one of the best golfers right now in golf. And how does that feel? What kind of feeling do you take from that? Because it's special.
Yeah, I think honestly, because I don't want to take credit for, you know,
well, you should.
You got to pull the trigger. That's just the bottom line in the end. But I think probably the best thing was when I was able to hold the U.S. Amateur Trophy and the U.S. Open Trophy together. Unfortunately, I was kind of stupid. I was sleeping with the NCAA trophy. I don't have the three of them together. It's like an idiot. So the fact that I have a picture with the gold medal and the U.S. Open trophy and U.S. Am trophy together, I mean, that's a feat. I can guarantee you probably at this point, there is no picture of another coach that has those two trophies together, you know? And so, who had that influence from day one, you know, to that moment. So, you know, I think that's a, you know, a lot of pride and everything about that it's surreal, you know, a cool moment. And hopefully maybe I'll be able to blow that picture up and post it somewhere. But
well, you should,
I think, that's, you know, a lot of pride and pride in what Bryson has accomplished and is going to accomplish.
Yeah.
and whatever, for whatever role I'm a part of, you know, I'm thankful and so on. No matter what, we're family, I think, it's hard to, again, I hate when people say I'm his swing coach, or I was his swing coach or swing teacher. I really just dislike that, to be honest with you. And I always have, because we're more than that. We have a relationship. We've talked about literally everything under the sun. And I think in some ways I've had an influence. In the end, again, he's an adult and he makes his own choices, his own decisions and stuff. But, you know, he does tell me about certain things. And I appreciate that, not just about the golf swing, about his life and what's going on. And he knows my family extremely well. So, you know, that's the way we are. And I hopefully that's the way it's always going to be.
Yeah. I took tremendous pride in being part of the whole process. And I'm so glad we were able to do that together as a team.
And look what I'm wearing today. I know nobody can see this, but you can.
The watch.
The watch, man.
I make watches, and I remember giving you and Bryson one when you won the when they won the amateur. That was such an amazing. Yeah. That was an amazing experience for me to be involved.
Still not sure how that whole thing happened, but yeah.
Yeah. No, I'm so proud to have been involved with you and well, Mike, as usual, I'm going to have you on in the future, so this is not just a onesie.
Anytime.
I appreciate your friendship. I appreciate you taking the time. Anything you want to add before we conclude?
Again, thank you. I've you've been a huge support for me, and I think anybody that doesn't have your fitting stuff is crazy. I still believe that. I always have since day one. And you're an innovator, and I feel very fortunate to be a part of that, and to have your stuff at the tent. You know, we've been enjoying fitting, putters with the new putter, which has been great. And again, your irons have been, in our makeup since day one. And so I look forward to see what new stuff is coming out, you know, for you, and hoping to always be a part of that.
All right, my friend. So tell the viewers how they can get a hold of you, find you.
Just MikeShy.com. Pretty easy. So very easy. And MikeShy Golf on Instagram. And if they ever have any questions, reach out. I'll do my best to get back to them.
You know, Mike is extremely accessible. And if you have the opportunity, you should reach out to him. He's truly one of the great teachers out there, a great thinker. And if you're in the area or you want to make the journey, it's well worth it. The atmosphere is infectious in his place, and Mike is an infectious personality, and you will love him. He's an amazing man and a good friend of mine. And we'll conclude with that. All right. Thank you, my friend.
Thanks, man.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Adele Golf Podcast. Make sure you stay tuned for more podcasts coming your way on a regular basis. Subscribe in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you're interested in going through a fitting process and finding the best putter for you, head over to AdeleGolf.com. Go to the Find a Fitter tab, scroll down, and find a fitter in your state nearby. Find a putter that you know is custom fit for your best performance. That's it for today. We'll see you next time.